Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Trish.
And this is our podcast.
Wait, Sarah. Who and who?
Who and who, indeed. Who, indeed. We talk about wrestling news and various topics from different promotions, primarily AEW, but also New Japan Pro Wrestling, WWE, and topics from around the wrestling world. Whatever we find interesting, and we hope you will too. We are a member of the Social Suplex Podcast Network, and you can find our content on our podcast feed, the Social Suplex Podcast feed, as well as on Twitter and YouTube. Please feel free to like, subscribe, and rate our podcast. It is Sunday, April 14th, 2024, and Trish and I are back in the studio for the third week in a row, which is a little bit unusual for us, but we wanted to take a second and thank everyone for all of your comments and tweets and responses on our last episode. It was really gratifying to both of us to see people listening to it and talking about it. It was, pretty awesome, and we are both very grateful to everyone who took the time to listen and think about it and talk about it. And, you know, wherever you were, whether you were intentionally tagging us or not, we appreciate it. It has been an absolutely crazy couple of weeks in wrestling. Even though we've had three podcasts in a row, there's still going to be so much stuff we don't get a chance to discuss. But we're going to kick off tonight's episode with the WWE. WWE are coming off a huge and very, very, very successful WrestleMania weekend. We had two nights of WrestleMania that started last week on Saturday and Sunday. The first night ended with a tag match between Roman Reigns and The Rock against Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins. The Rock got the pin. And then the next night, in a Bloodline Rules match, where basically everybody and their brother did a run-in, including the Undertaker of all people, Cody Rhodes finally finished his story. He is the WWE champion, and we have moved on to as WWE was very anxious for all of us to know, the Paul Levesque era of WWE, right? You can tell by my tone that Trish and I are not particularly impressed by this. So there's a bunch of topics to discuss with WWE. We're going to kick this off first. I think the biggest thing so far is just the overall reaction to WrestleMania, which has been insanely positive. I think even more positive than I think Trish and I think they deserved. Dave Meltzer was on Wrestling Observer Radio talking about how Cody Rhodes is possibly one of the greatest baby faces of all time. Brian Alvarez talked about how WrestleMania was one of the best WrestleMania nights ever. They both discussed extensively how WWE and AEW essentially are the same in-ring, which I don't know that I agree with. Trish, what was your thoughts about WrestleMania weekend and the response to it from the wrestling media?
You know, no one can deny that it was extremely successful.
Right, it was very successful.
Yeah, so they released a press release saying that they had 1.3 billion live minutes watched across both nights. Brandon Thurston did the math on that and thinks that it was 2.7 million to 2.9 million Peacock accounts who watched. And that's not viewers. So in comparison, the NFL wildcard game that was on back in January, the Chiefs Dolphins game, that had 22.86 million viewers. So I guess there might be a way to extrapolate that, but it's still a huge, huge amount of viewership. The gate-wise, they did $38.5 million across both nights, so an average of $19.3 million, which with inflation will make it the third and fourth biggest gates in WWE history behind WrestleMania 32 in Dallas and WrestleMania 35 at MetLife Stadium. So it's incredibly financially successful event. And it's definitely one of the most well-received from the wrestling media and from the WWE fan base. So what I will say is, you know, as much as it got very much kind of, we only see the good in things and we didn't look at some of the issues, what they do well, and I think this is a key thing because I think a lot of people who live at AEW can't always understand this, is they satisfy their own fan base very well at the moment.
Yes.
In a way that they haven't done for years. And maybe they don't need as much as an AEW fan, or it doesn't resonate in the same way with the media. I think they are judged on different platforms, but you're judged against your own history in a lot of ways. But yeah, at the moment, they are delivering, that Mania delivered for their fan base. And yes, that's why you got the reaction that you did. And the keys to that is, you know, they booked baby faces to win. They gave you the key moments. So they had Sami Zayn, you know, defeat Gunther. he has his key moment. Is it the one they wanted last year with the title? No, but it's enough for the fan base to be satisfied. The same with LA Knight getting a key win over AJ Styles, and the same with Cody getting that kind of key babyface win at the end of the night. And that is something that's, it's a huge play for them. You know, at the moment, and this sounds so crazy when you consider all the things that have happened outside of, you know, the actual wrestling ring. And even like when you talk about The Rock, you know, inserting himself into the story and then how that was reversed. But they are the babyface company. In the media.
Yes.
They are the babyface company. And to their fan base currently, they are the babyface company. And that makes everything else easier to ignore.
Yes. It's, you know, like you said, they have done a very good job of, you know, the way that the whole weekend positioned Triple H and his leader, you know, his quote unquote leadership, and the way that he's, you know, handled WWE and its booking, it was very much like, you know, he's here now, everything's great, Triple H is taking care of it, you know, and, you know, all they had to do was just a modicum of competent booking, right? Like, mm-hmm. They're really, the bar was pretty low, and, you know, it's kind of sad for WWE fans that it's been how long since they've had that modicum of competent booking, right? That it hasn't been like another, you know, Roman Reigns versus Brock Lesnar match. You know, like I'm happy for them, but it is kind of disturbing how quickly people were ready to, like, you know, jump on the whole WWE's phenomenal, right? And it's kind of like, it's better. Like, it's definitely better, mm-hmm. but phenomenal seems like maybe a bridge too far for me.
What they have always done well is their promotional side.
Yes.
So they present people like stars. Not always, but their main people. We talked about it, we talked about the rating episode and how they focus on people. And when you are on the upswing, it's a lot easier to do that and to make that correspond with that. You know, Triple H is not a... I don't think he's a fantastic booker. I don't think he's phenomenal anyway. What I think he is he does very basic, slow, logical storytelling in the most part.
Yes.
Not always, because, you know, no book is perfect. But it's enough that they deliver kind of, and, you know, it's always been a moments company, but deliver key moments as and when to keep everybody kind of hooked in. And, you know, the key for what they've done over the last year is they've managed to elevate people up and then down as they wish.
Yeah.
And they've made fans believe that if you get behind somebody, that they will be elevated. And that's, you know, and that not always is the case. And I think that's something that AEW is currently struggling from, is, you know, everyone's in their status quo and everyone recognises it. The Paul-esque era. Okay.
So you can't even say it with a straight face.
This one was really, really interesting because as much as they were telling everybody that they were a babyface brand in terms of their product, they were also trying to present themselves as a babyface brand in terms of their corporate side as well.
Yes.
And that's what this was all about. So it was very much like, this is the brand now. Vince McMahon, evil man, is gone. We aren't going to acknowledge anything else around the culture. We're just going to say it's Vince. And that was a continued message all the way through the week, you know, from the CM Punk interview with Ariel Helwani to the kind of appearances on Pat McAfee, the Nick Khan interviews that he did, all the way through to Stephanie McMahon opening up night two, you know, with its the Paul Levesque era, and even into the press conference where it's like, oh, she feels, you know, comfortable and safe again. It's like, well, when she left WWE, they said it wasn't for anything like that.
Right.
She just felt like they needed to step back. So why didn't she feel comfortable? You know, but no one's going to question that. But it very much is a rebranding, and it's like, it was a retelling of history. So when Cody got to the end and he was doing his kind of rah-rah stuff and celebration, you know, he goes to Nick Khan, they put that on screen. They want that part of leadership. He calls out Triple H. He calls out Bruce Pritchard and says he was the reason for coming here, but also, you know, ignores the fact that it was Bruce and Vince McMahon.
Right.
So it was kind of that rewriting of history that WWE are so, so good at in terms of, and you think about it, you know, everyone talks about WCW is just because of the documentaries that they've produced. So they are very, very good at that. The Cody match itself was interesting because, you know, watching it as someone who's not been invested in that Cody character probably makes it different. but it was very much structured, very similar to a match back at WrestleMania 31, which was the Sting and Triple H match. So you had 20 minutes of kind of very basic grappling with not, didn't feel like there was a massive amount of heat. And then they kind of had the Royal Rumble entrances to the point where I think at one point Solo Sikoa is actually looking up and waiting for somebody to run down like he's giving a rumble. So I can understand, you know, it delivers in the emotion and I can understand why people were so excited about it. And I don't know if it's something I'd want to do with a world champion at the end of, you know, such a long reaching story. But it's clear that it satisfied that part of the fan base.
What I thought was fascinating was the responses to Raw the next night, right? Mm-hmm. Because Raw did a huge number. Rock showed up on Monday. He and Cody did another one of those 45-minute intro promos. He got a special – he gave Cody a special present that nobody knows what it is, so now we have this mystery to occupy ourselves for however really long. Rock was like, I have to go back to my home planet, Cody Rhodes. You took care of the WWE universe. And jetted off in his fancy outfit. But the most of the reactions I saw to Raw that night, it was very much reminded me of the night that CM Punk showed up after Survivor Series, where a lot of people were like, oh my God, they just had this incredible WrestleMania, and oh, the TV product is very boring now. Like, it's still boring. Like, there's not enough going on to get you super interested in a three-hour Raw. You know, and I don't know, that was kind of one of those things that kind of jumped out at me. And what I found was funny is even some of the casual fans that I know were like, yeah, it was kind of boring and I don't really see there's a lot of reason to watch it until The Rock comes back, which I kind of was shocked by because, you know, people were like, yay, Cody. But then it's like, yeah, he won, you know, that was kind of a weird reaction to me.
They've got a big challenge. So, you know, their turnaround was based off the Bloodline story getting hot. And yes. It actually happened before Triple H took power. You know, that was happening while Vince McMahon was still there. But that was the kind of the first kind of building block. And then, you know, acquiring Cody around that time as well. You know, the Seth Rollins program was very, very hot. They sold out the building in Chicago for the cage match. And it had like a huge resale price. So they were kind of in the midst of that as Triple H came aboard. And then, yeah, it's managed to kind of continue to build. They've carried that momentum. But they've kind of reached that kind of end focal point where you have so many stories that have kind of reached an end. And, you know, you're going to run into the same issue that AEW had after the Hangman Kenny thing concluded. And then they saw TV ratings drop for a period and then they lucked into the move to TBS in some ways. But you've had this consistent reason to watch for a long, long period of time. And, you know, you could even argue that Cody was losing somewhat steam in January before the Rumble. And then this thing with The Rock kind of, you know, if you watched the reactions to the end of the Rumble, it wasn't, yeah, you know, momentous. So then they had this thing with The Rock and it's kind of re-energized that program. And The Rock's come in and been, you know, huge impact to that business.
Yes, yes.
And we knew back in January, we saw that day one rating that if he was all over TV, then they would be doing consistently, you know, great numbers going into Mania. But now you're going to have, you know, The Rock is back maybe, what, January? SummerSlam at best. You're going to have no John Cena. They used John Cena on Monday night for, I think, quarter 6 and 7, you know, to tie in the start of the NCAA championship game. So you're not going to have that guy to help out your impact. You haven't got Seth Rollins for 4 weeks. You know, Becky Lynch might be on a break as well. You don't have Roman Reigns.
Yeah. Yeah,
that might be SummerSlam. So in a way, you've got the risk for them. It's actually more similar to, you think about AEW after Revolution, you know, is the stories that you have that follow aren't as strong as the ones that have come before. And the star power isn't as strong as what you had before. And that will, it will lead to, you know, a lag in interest. And last year they kind of combated that because the Bloodline story was still going.
Yes.
And they did the huge tag in London with the Usos against Roman and Solo, and then into SummerSlam, where that story kind of petered out at SummerSlam, but then they had all the returns. You know, they had Randy Orton coming back, they had CM Punk. You know, who else? They had John Cena for that next full period. So they relied on these things. The difficulty is that, you know, normally you'd accept that lull when you know that we're about to go into the NBA, NHL playoffs, and that sort of thing. But
I don't know if he has the ability to do that, Triple H, because the way that Endeavor work is that you constantly have to deliver results.
Yeah.
And when he was put in that power position, I remember the initial Wade Keller report said, you know, it's about accountability. So you can't live off the past. So he's had a great weekend. WWE have had a fantastic weekend.
Phenomenal.
But the way that they work is that you have to consistently deliver this. So you need to consistently deliver bigger gates. You need to deliver growth. You need to deliver these TV ratings. And, you know, even though they've got the Netflix deal lined up and the USA deal, they also have no place for Raw in the fall. So you need to still be delivering something because you want to get that content out somewhere. You know, that's still a deal that's kind of sat there. So, yeah, their difficulty is, you know, consistently delivering these things. And UFC are very good at that. You look at the UFC show last night, I think it was a $17 million gate, biggest in that arena. And they consistently do that. You know, you read the report after every kind of big UFC show, and it's like they smashed the gate. So there is this accountability that he needs to consistently do that. And it does make you look at, you take that top of that card out, and you are now going to take the top of that card out. Are they able to deliver the same things? Are they able to deliver the same numbers? And same with the houses as well. You know, like Montreal won't be at the level that it was for the last time they were there for the ones before Elimination Chamber last year. Can understand that. You know, Sami Zayn, hometown guy. But you need to continually deliver these top numbers. And that's going to be a huge challenge this year. You know, you look at their programs coming up for the Backlash show in France. And it's like, you know, Bayley's in this thing with Naomi and Tiffany. You know, Jey Uso and Damian Priest, who's already being referred to as a transitional champion. Cody's going to face the winner of LA Knight versus AJ Styles. I'm not sure they will draw anywhere near as close of excitement as the what's come previous. There's definitely more of a lull this year. And maybe some of that is because last year's WrestleMania was less kind of star-studded in some ways.
Yeah.
So there was more of a focus on these are our current guys, whereas this year there was a mix of these are our current guys, but actually, you know, this is built around The Rock. So it will be really interesting to see kind of how that plays out going forward. And, you know, the other thing about Triple H is he better be untouchable.
Well, this is the part that I think is really interesting. And I think when one of the things I'm frustrated by with some of the recent coverage of WWE is the lack of a discussion about the risks that WWE currently faces, because they do face risks, right? We've talked about some of the risks from a wrestling perspective, but there's business risks that are associated with them as well. And when I talk about business risks and I discuss this, it's not to say that these things will happen, right? But there are some potential things that could be a big problem for them out there and down the road, and specifically out there for Triple H, because one of the things you could say about wrestling under Vince McMahon and WWE under Vince McMahon is that Vince McMahon was a wrestling promoter first. He may have not always liked it. He may have hated it. He had a complicated relationship with wrestling. But at the end of the day, I was thinking about this today. You know, Vince refused for years to put an advertisement on the mat for any of his shows because he didn't like the way it looked and he didn't think it was any good. Vince is gone, and what did we have at WrestleMania? A giant Prime energy drink logo dead center, which Cody kissed at one point, which is weird.
God.
Okay, so like there were things, as much as we justifiably shit on Vince McMahon's wrestling promotion instincts, he did have them, and he was responsible. He was the person running the company and yada, yada, yada. There's the people running the company now, right? So TKO is a publicly owned company. The majority of its stock is owned by Endeavor, right? Endeavor is also a publicly traded company. The majority of Endeavor stock is owned by a private equity firm called Silver Lake. Silver Lake made an announcement, I think it was this week, last week, that they are planning on taking Endeavor private, which means that they are going to buy all the stock that's available and they will own Endeavor, and that will be a private company. And, you know, one of the things that is the difference between WWE and AEW is that in the United States, publicly traded companies are required to disclose financial information publicly because anyone can go into a, you know, a stockbroker store and buy stock in that company, right? When you have a private company, you are obligated to disclose less. You're still governed by the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is the regulatory agency that handles businesses in the United States, but there's less paperwork around what you have to do because there's no risk to a public consumer, right? You're a private company. So Endeavor is a private equity firm, and I think you could talk about private equity in general, and there are probably folks who listen to this podcast are a lot smarter and know more about it than I do. But the goal of a private equity company is to make profits. And Silver Lake has an extensive portfolio, you can go to their website and look, of a bunch of different businesses that they own majority stakes in or that they own. And the goal of this is to make profits. So for WWE, they are now going to be majority owned by a private equity firm, and they are no longer, the goal is for the number to go up, right? That, like you said, Trish, they have to make more profits. They have to be more successful. And WWE has been tremendously successful in the last couple of years in terms of they've divested away from fan direct consumer payment, right? Where the money is coming from us paying for pay-per-views and everything else. Now the money that WWE is making is coming from media companies. It's also coming from municipalities, because with the Saudi Arabia deal, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia pays WWE to go and put shows on there. And that's now a model that they have incorporated with a lot of their other shows, right? WWE went to a smaller town in Australia rather than a big metropolis because the smaller town paid them. And I say smaller town, and these are cities, and I'm my America-centric.
One of our Aussie friends is going to...
I've infuriated at least three people that I know of. I'm so sorry. But you get the gist, right? So right now we're in a situation where a big show, I am confident that there's a marketing slide deck out there that WWE has and TKO has that they present where they talk about all the revenue from money that you can bring in. So my tax dollars are being used to pay WWE so SummerSlam can go to Cleveland or wherever, right? And that's part of what they are attempting to diversify and... some of the stuff they're doing with media deals and their corporate partnerships, right? They're trying to make money. All of this is extremely important. And if the product suffers and they don't, that line does not continue to go up, there will be tremendous pressure on TKO and WWE to do something about it. And when that shit happens, what's the first thing that happens? People get fired, right? Somebody in Triple H's position gets walked out the door. So it did feel like, and I thought about was it 2 or 3 weeks ago that you talked about this, Trish, where you were like, why is Triple H on the show more now than he's ever been? Why is Triple H the focal point? And Sean Ross Sapp had a really interesting article after WrestleMania that talked about everybody's so happy backstage, but one of the most ominous things, the most ominous sentence in that entire thing was the talent, this is a quote, the talent was told that Endeavor believes that anyone can be replaced in the event of misdoing, even important figures can be removed, right? Mm-hmm. That's chilling.
But that was very similar to what happened with UFC. So yes. You had people that had lifetime jobs who suddenly didn't anymore.
Right.
And we've seen that this week. We've seen pretty much the entire talent relations division just kind of disappear into thin air, including somebody who'd been with the company for longer than literally their longest tenured employee.
Yes, Sue Aitchison, who is the senior director of talent relations, was let go on Friday. WWE also let go with executive vice president of talent Dan Ventrell, and senior vice president of athlete ID and development Trent Wilfiger was also let go. So they gutted their talent relations department.
And you can actually see the reason for that, because they have missed out on all free agents so far this year, and picking up Tama Tonga is not the same as picking up Okada.
he wants the grind, Trish. He wants the grind.
Yes. Okay. get myself in trouble. No, it's not the same. But all the people that could be potential difference makers, they've not managed to acquire. And Triple H can talk people down about the grind all he wants. They wanted these people. He wouldn't be talking about them if he didn't want these people. But they've also got, an impending contract situation. So you've got just of the ones that we're aware of. Sheamus has had some time added on, but his contract's due up. Finn Balor's contract is due up this summer. You've got Drew McIntyre's contract due up, and then, his contract, I believe, is now going to run till after the Clash at the Castle in Glasgow, which I'm sure winning the title there is going to be dangled as a... on a, like a... it's all going on a fishing rod, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then you've also got... two of the most fundamental people in the last 5 years for them, whether you think of Seth or not, Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch. Becky Lynch, arguably the biggest female draw that they've had outside of Ronda Rousey coming in. So they're not small names, and I'm sure there's other names that we don't know about.
So they literally have a contract situation where these contracts aren't done and they are running into the final moments. It's actually kind of reminiscent of 2021 with the Adam Cole and Bryan Danielson thing and how they screwed up knowing where Cole's contract was up to. So it makes absolute sense. You know, this is, it was interesting to hear Dave Meltzer say this weekend that there are some criticisms of Triple H inside the company. You know, it's, he's had a good weekend, but it's not all kind of all happy about it. So there are pressures, and you know, in terms of streamlining, they there was a thing about they're cutting their some of their production costs and bringing less people to kind of TV, and you are going to see more of that. You are going to see more streamlining. They're not going to want to keep everybody. You know, we saw this with UFC with Francis Ngannou. It doesn't matter so much what position you're in; it just matters what you deliver,
right?
And that will be consistent across WWE. And that doesn't matter if it's Triple H, it doesn't matter if it's Nick Khan, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, a wrestler. They will base everybody off the value that they deliver. And that's a huge change. It's a huge change. And it's different from, yeah, from Vince McMahon and kind of, it didn't matter, did it? You know, he delivered the product that he wanted to deliver. Now they have to deliver a product that makes more money each time.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And you talked about Raw not being on television this fall, and there's already been rumors that SmackDown might be moved to FS1 starting in September.
It will be.
Yeah. So you're already going to be in a place where your ratings are going to take a hit, and it's going to look like less people are watching. Like I said, it's frustrating to watch the way that so much of the coverage this week laid out, right? Where it was like WWE good, AEW bad, and no matter what happened, you couldn't seem to break out of that, regardless of the fact that, you know, there are risks to WWE, and it's not necessarily all smooth sailing there.
He wouldn't be trying to make himself invincible if that was the case.
Correct.
And that's what it felt like. This was very much like, well, you can't take me out because there'll be a fan revolt similar to what happened with Cody.
Right.
But it did get a bit much. You know, you don't need to see a guy open up two shows, get that first pop, which was kind of hilarious. You just don't need it. We'll see what happens. You know, there's a lot of people gone. They've got a lot of things. I think they have a lot more things to navigate than people think. People just go, oh, they have these TV deals, everything's fine. But they have different pressures, you know, to AEW. Yeah. And I'm not surprised that we've seen this. You know, it was successful. It was, well, you know, it was a very well-received event. I expected, you know, we always get that hyperbole whenever there is anything like this.
Yeah.
So I wasn't entirely surprised. And Nick Khan is very good at his media job.
Yes. Yes.
He controls the media like for anyone else, you know, from the Ariel Helwani thing at the very start of the week with CM Punk and the lines that were spread out there to the kind of constant kind of jabbing at AEW that was done kind of all the way through the week. And then even like, you know, you see Bubba Ray Dudley out there as a referee, you know, who's on one of the most successful radio wrestling shows, who bashes AEW on a regular basis. And you're like, yeah, you can see his media strategy. He's very, very clever at it. And that kind of feeds into everything else in terms of, and very good at parroting the right phrases as well. You know, how many times have I heard the words WCW 2000 in the last 6-7 months?
Right.
And he infuses that, you know, that they have lines that they go with. So yeah, that's been very much part of it. But then it's funny that I don't know if they expected a bite back on that media strategy.
It's, I think, understated in all this, and I do think people realize this, but like, it's worth saying again, you know, Nick Khan's career started, you know, once he finished his lost career, he started as an agent, and he represented sports and broadcast journalists, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he first came into contact with Triple H because he was Tim Tebow's agent. He was Ariel Helwani's agent. And to Ariel Helwani's credit, he's not shy about saying that. He's disclosed that repeatedly. But, you know, Nick Khan has these relationships with, you know, all of these different media personalities. And I think anybody, forget, you know, wrestling, there are a lot of professions where relationships are very important. And I think, you know, it's understated that it doesn't necessarily have to be a, you know, campaign, a specific campaign, as much as is, hey, we love Nick, he's a great guy, you know, oh, he's with WWE now, let's talk about this, let's promote this. I think a lot of people sometimes are very quick to say, well, AEW needs a PR strategy and AEW should do this. And I'm certain there are probably things within AEW with PR strategies they could do a better job on. But it's not like they're WWE and AEW are not at the same starting line when it comes to this stuff. WWE has this incredible advantage, not just because of the fact that it's the market leader, the fact that it's been around for 20 years longer, but because of the relationships that someone like Nick Khan has within just the media, sports media and journalism in general, right? And that does a tremendous amount in terms of pushing that PR positively forward for WWE.
And he fully understands that, you know, you control the media, it's much easier to control people.
Yep.
You know, people parrot things on a regular basis that come through them channels.
Right.
And also, you know, it's kind of funny that they thought they had complete control of the media this week, and then AEW kind of threw a wrench into that.
Oh, yeah.
And that week that they thought, because the thing about WWE at the moment is they are very sure of their identity. They yes. are very sure on their product, and that allows them to kind of look and venture into other people's realms. So whether that be trying to look at, you know, building more international relationships with other companies because they feel that's an advantage. That his whole thing is to pick off the advantages that he feels that a company like AEW would have. Right. And one of the first things he did was realize that there was this media thing of everyone thinking WWE is awful. And at the time, you know, AEW was hot. So how can I change that? How can I adapt that? How can I make this to the point where I am so comfortable in our position that I can spend one of our biggest weeks of the year just kind of taking shots at AEW continuously and thinking they won't fight back? Because that's, you know, very similar to the strategy that Vince has used for decades. But that's kind of the basis of it. Should we talk about the fight back and that thing I said I would never talk about again? And I put it in a box.
We put it in the box. We put the box in the closet. And then 4 hours later, we went, fuck.
Nobody is ever going to believe that timing wasn't intentional, are they?
Yeah, no, never.
No.
You know what? Let things work to our advantage sometimes.
Sure.
So on Saturday night, on Collision aired Saturday night of last week. It was the 6th, April 6th. Collision aired after the NCAA basketball game. So it was a late night. And halfway through the Collision episode, the announcement came out that the Young Bucks would be sharing footage from All In. And needless to say, this came after night one of WrestleMania, which I think by most accounts was good, but not set the world on fire good. So the pump was sort of primed for something exciting to happen. So when I woke up on Sunday morning, you know, nobody was talking about night one of WrestleMania. They were all talking about the fact that the footage was going to come out. And there was a lot of people were like, well, this is the Young Bucks trolling. They're not going to actually show the footage of Jack Perry and CM Punk. It's going to be like a swerve. And then so AEW made an effort very quickly to get the news out to Dave Meltzer and Sean Ross Sapp and others that they were in fact going to be showing the actual footage of the actual fight. So everybody and their brother had an absolute meltdown in various eccentrical ways, to the point where, before we get into all this, I just want to take a side note. And if I thought this out properly, I'd lean in and have producer Leah pull up some kind of publicly available calming music. But just guys, and I want to speak to everybody who is an AEW fan. We have got to calm down a little bit. Like, we've got to take a breath. We've got to chill out. It's not the end of the world if WWE has a good week and AEW, like, to borrow a phrase from Trish, has an own goal. Like, we're going to get through it. Like, we're going to end up doing something else. What happened? Everybody just has to freaking chill out. Everybody lost their collective minds. People were saying it was a bad idea. People were saying it was a good idea. The people who thought it was a bad idea were fighting with the people who thought it was a good idea. It was just, there were endless comparisons to WCW. It was like, you know, oh my God, it was nuts. Okay. So Dynamite happens. The footage is aired. As everyone pretty much suspected, it is part of an angle between the Young Bucks and FTR, is how it's presented. There's a backstage promo where the Young Bucks present the footage, discuss Jack Perry, and talk about how they were so upset after this fight that they couldn't even pray or have a glass of water, and that's why they lost the, you know. And another side note, Nick Jackson's ability to just find the douchiest hats imaginable. Like, every week I think there's not going to be another douchebag hat, and yet we come out with them. It's pretty impressive.
We're getting Tunnel Talk influenced here.
I'm getting Tunnel Talk influenced. Sartorial choices. What can I tell you? So they air the footage, they cut back to the promo, and then we cut to the ring where FTR come out to give a speech. And I am often verbal and vocal about my, you know, boredom with FTR. And in this regard, I felt a little bit bad for them, right? Because the way this whole thing was set up, the decision to incorporate it as part of an angle sort of made sense, but it was so labored and difficult. And even the Young Bucks, who I think would be more successful than anyone else, are going to have a difficult time with doing this. And they had the benefit of doing it in a promo that was pre-taped. The FTR was forced to go out to the ring and present, you know, a babyface motivation for this. And this is like, this requires like a doctoral level of ability with promos, right?
It required a John Moxley.
FTR, God love them, they barely have a high school diploma in promos. Like, they're just not good at them. And like, so you're asking FTR to go out there and have a reason for this. And again, it ultimately boiled down to, we want to be the best tag team in the world, which is just the, guys, you got to come up with something else. We got to come up with something else. I need another reason to invest in FTR other than that they want to be the best wrestlers in the world. Okay. And then, of course, later on in the episode, there's a Okada squash. There's a fracas. The FTR comes out. The Young Bucks come out. And, of course, we end up with CM Punk chance, which is the last fucking thing you want. So, Trish, we'll talk about this. I don't think this... We are very lucky in that we do not do instant reaction shows, because having a couple days to think about this is really beneficial. I don't know that this was as successful as it could have been. And I think the biggest concern that I had about it going into it was that it would not work within the alignments and the way that you've set this feud up, right? The Young Bucks are the heels. FTR are the baby faces. So you've now put yourself in a situation where you've shown a video of CM Punk attacking an employee, and we've discussed this at length last week, CM Punk and management attacking an employee, and you're saying that the people defending CM Punk are the baby faces in this feud, right? And so now you have a situation where the Young Bucks are going to have CM Punk chanted at them, even by fans who are well-meaning, because this is part of this feud now, right? Like, it just didn't make a lot of sense. And I do feel like the wrestlers involved were trying their hardest. But I do think after all of this that Tony Khan probably would have been better off just leaking this footage to somebody, because I don't know if it works with the alignment. It's just messy.
Yeah, I don't think I have, and I've been thinking about this obviously nonstop, probably since Wednesday night, and I don't think I have an answer of whether they should have used the footage or not. I don't think I have like a defined argument or like, but let's start with, we kind of got to go through everything individually. So, it did provide a narrative for this program.
Yes, yes.
A narrative that was missing in a cold tournament, in a match that we've already seen multiple times.
Right.
Okay. But I think you're right. I think the alignment is wrong. And you could feel it. So, first of all, there is this thing of AEW is not a babyface company.
No.
It's not been a babyface company for a long, long period of time now. And that is something that over the next period of time, they need to correct. You know, like, you need that support of your fan base behind them. But the fan base currently, I don't think, trusts AEW in a large part. And some of that is that you have some of the people most recognizable with the promotion as the bad guys, and you are playing off that and you are making money off it. And it's right, you know, they are heels.
Yeah.
And they are much better as heels. But in this circumstance, yeah, you are in a way baby facing people that, you know, I don't think it would have worked better if it wasn't FTR, because these are the same guys that did the whole, you know, are we staying or are we going contract thing for 5 months, 6 months after they re-signed in like November of 2022. They're also the same guys that did the kind of the Dax podcast that tried to wipe out a lot of respectable media and say everybody was lying, and then, you know, prolong this kind of thing and bring up all this kind of CM Punk elite stuff for the majority of the start of 2023. So these guys are not just, we want to move on, guys.
Yeah.
And the audience recognizes that.
Yeah.
So it didn't feel like the right people to do this with. But I can understand what it, yeah, I think the big thing is that, yeah, you have to be careful now with these characters and to try to provide a narrative that moves away from the footage and moves forward. And the thing that's been the thing with the Bucks characters is when they come in, they can incorporate things from, you know, the CM Punk stuff into their characters, but their characters have been, you know, we're
basically people that couldn't manage a target. That literally is the characters. But it's, yeah, we're the egotistical bosses, you know, we want like these kind of elder guys out of the company, and it's like we're deluded. And, you know, they did a good job of playing into that with the promo before. And the thing is nobody's ever going to remember the promo before.
No.
And I thought they did a good job of kind of saying this footage isn't sensational and that sort of thing. But people aren't going to think about that because they just think about the footage. Now, yeah, so you have to move that forward and use it as part of your story. You know, and Chris Jericho is doing a funny little gimmick that's going under the radar that is also based on experiences with CM Punk. So that's tickled me mildly that not many people have picked up on that. But then you've also got Drew McIntyre using it over in WWE for, you know, story and for heat. So you can incorporate these things. And there is an argument that with Jack coming back that you would need to incorporate some of it because everybody knows the story pretty much. And even when he's tried to kind of put press out to kind of get rid of the story, like the thing that went out to Brian Alvarez to deny the thing that that Dave Meltzer put out about apologizing Tony Khan and being ignored, that sort of thing, protect his story, you've kind of run away from that now. And watching that footage, and we can kind of get into the, I'll give you some of the original things about footage that's kind of funny. Before we saw it, my main concerns were the alignments. And because you could see that coming and you kind of knew where the story was going with Jack. But also there was that thing of what is this going to do for him coming back as a babyface or a heel? Because when I watched it afterwards, the first thing I could think of was not, oh, look, it shows exactly what we thought happened or was CM Punk or anything like that or, you know, the aggression or anything. My first thought was they've treated Jack Perry like in a completely unfair manner. It looks so bad on them as a company.
It's so I think the part of this is challenging to discuss, right? Is that there's a couple different ways to tackle it, right? There's the decision to release the footage at all, period. There's the decision to push back on WWE as part of that. There's the way that it fits into it from a storyline perspective. There's what it says about the company itself. And I understood the reason why they wanted to release the footage in general. I get it. And I think one of the frustrating things this week has been people saying, oh, well, it confirms CM Punk's account. Because it fucking doesn't. But, you know, well, if you want to, like, it fucking doesn't. Maybe kind of what he sort of intimated on Helwani, but he certainly left a bunch of shit out. And the stuff that he released to people when the fight happened, what he said was totally different. So that was kind of infuriating. So I don't necessarily have an issue with them deciding to release the footage at all. Because I do think, like, when people talk about, like, oh, the perception, like as a few people have said, what is the worst thing that could happen to AEW if they release this footage? Like, it's not going to prevent them from getting a TV deal, right? Does it impact their storytelling? Sure. Does it have a, like, other stuff? Fine. But, like, in terms of, like, an immediate, like, you know, sometimes you just got to, like, one of the difficult things with AEW is people say, well, they should fight back, but not this week, like, in a different way. Like, you know, that's a lot easier said than done. The flip side of this is that I genuinely started to question whether Tony Khan has any understanding of how his base audience feels about CM Punk. Like, I as an AEW fan, like, good riddance. I have never gotten the impression that there are giant percentages of AEW fans who are weeping into their, like, fucking cereal about CM Punk no longer being part of the company. I do think there are some people that really wanted him there, but I think there's a very vocal minority, and I think there's a lot of AEW fans that are just very happy to move on, right? And that's part of why the alignment thing is so fucked up, because you say to me as an AEW fan, the Bucks are the bad guys, which in kayfabe, I'm fully on board with, right? But I also really don't fucking want to hear people chant CM Punk at the Young Bucks, because, you know, from my perspective, I kind of think they were pretty much in the right for most of it. And to watch Jungle Boy get fucking attacked at work, and if you want to argue, oh, he deserved a suspension because of yada, 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 fine. But the guy got fucking attacked by work by somebody who was senior to him, and then he's off TV for 9 months. Like, that's kind of bullshit. Like, it's not, it makes AEW look like shit. It makes Tony Khan look petty as fuck.
And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I asked for feedback in terms of, you know, why, if you're an AEW fan and you've not gone over across to WWE, do you feel less connected? And a lot of it was that they don't identify with the brand as in the way that they did anymore. You know, this thing of kind of presenting this thing where it was that Change the World ideology that we spoke about last week.
Right.
And there is a part of the fan base that struggles with the way the brand is presented now and the way that it looks like, it, the perception of how people behave. And this did play into that a little bit. Do you want me to read the initial things that went out from the camps?
Yeah.
I think they could be good.
This stuff that the punk camp was sending out to people about the fight right after it happened.
Okay, so the original description from PW Insider, okay, was, as you might imagine, depending on who is telling the story, it either begins with punk going after Perry or Perry confronting punk. It's been back and forth as to who to blame and where blame is being placed, depending on who is telling the story. They were shoving back and forth from there. The story is that the punk either punched or choked out Perry after the shoving. So that was a neutral thing, okay?
Yep.
The original one that Punk gave to Fightful is, we have learned at least one side of the story, which claims that Jack Perry approached CM Punk backstage and stepped into his face and bumped Punk. Punk was said to allegedly then push Perry. Perry allegedly then came at Punk and got choked, quote. We haven't heard a particular type of choke or who broke things up. Okay? The Perry version, which was in the Observer that week after, was that Punk said the words to the effect of, you know I could fuck you up at any time, right? Which Punk has now admitted to on the Eru Harani show. That version was then pie-faced Perry and tried to put on a guillotine and also threw some punches that were awkward from the position Punk was not doing any damage, while Perry grabbed Punk's arm to try and keep him from locking in the move. Samoa Joe came in and quickly broke it up. Perry didn't have a bruise or scratch on him past those that he got from the match. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, the thing is that people say, oh, it matches Punk's version. And again, it was like very much half-truth. So you can see that he was the aggressor, that he wasn't being responsible, quote-unquote. And the original things, the descriptions that he was giving people, suggest that he knew that he was wrong in terms of being that guy that went to Perry.
Right.
So that was why they kind of created the perception that he had stood to him. And the other thing, thinking about this, actually, was my concern was, is that people would, and I know other people raised it, is look at, you know, he did lunge towards Tony Khan.
Yeah.
But that isn't said to be the incident where he said he feared for his life. In fact, right. And there was another incident, which Wade Keller said was in Punk's dressing room, that was reported that week, which was also mentioned in the Observer the week after, which was described as another situation after the match involving Khan and Punk. There were no witnesses to that past it happened, and Khan came out of it very upset. In fact, someone at the Punk camp actually said, lots of screaming and crying at the time. So I thought, because they weren't going to go into the second incident, that people would immediately downplay the whole footage because of that. And they did, you know.
Of course.
I don't think this changes anything. If it had been released to the media the week after, with all of Punk's kind of stories at the time, then it would. But there was enough half-truths in there. It was close enough that the people that support Punk would see it like there was nothing wrong with it. And the people that see it the other way would continue to see it the other way. There was nothing in there that was going to change anybody's mind. Did it do its job? So people compare it to Finger Poke of Doom. Keep hearing this one. Finger Poke of Doom. I don't think half the people are old enough to have actually witnessed the Finger Poke of Doom, let's say it. And
no,
they probably just think of that WCW documentary. I'm pretty sure. So the thing about the Finger Poke of Doom episode is that they also announced that Mick Foley was going to win the world title over on Raw, which was a pre-taped episode. And that cost them 600,000 viewers that changed from Nitro to Raw. So the measure and the finger pump,
finger punk of doom. Right, you popped me with that one.
Oh, but the measure of the finger poke of doom is that it was a ratings disaster. And then they had continually kind of drops in ratings for the next several months to the point where they went from, an average in January 99 of 4.8 rating to, by the time they got to June, they were at 3.3. Thanks, Peter Edge, for the figures for there. So was this a ratings failure? And this is what it was going to hinge on. So we'll talk about why they released the footage in a second. But the key reason that Tony's citing is they were going to use it as a ratings ploy. In a similar way to, so they got the attention from WWE, and they're getting kind of all this kind of battering. and can they turn that into something for their program? And they did this in 2021. So you had Chris Jericho went on the Stone Cold Steve Austin podcast.
Yes.
Straight after WrestleMania. And it was a period where they were getting absolutely battered previous to that. So the challenge in NXT was really eating into them. And I remember lots of people saying Kenny should lose the belt. It's funny how people do that so early in a reign that ends up looking successful. funny. But there was this huge challenge for them. And then he goes on that podcast, NXT's move the next week, and they do a gigantic number. And part of that was they gained extra attention because of the attention that WWE put on them.
Right.
And this felt in some ways that they were doing a similar thing. So they took that attention from WWE and they wanted to turn it into a rating. Did it do it? Yeah. Yeah. So they delivered a 0.30. Yeah, yep. Highest since January 17th, which was the Hook Samoa Joe match, where they used a similar tactic. You know, they used a similar gimmick because this is a gimmick. You know, the idea of putting something like this on your show as a gimmick to drive a rating is not a new concept. It's not even close. And it's something that, you know, WCW used in the past. It's something that WWE have used. It's something it's been a consistent thing to do. So it's kind of funny hearing people say like it's the end of the world and no one should ever do it. But yeah, so it did do a good rating. I think the standout in the rating was the 18 to 34 because the last 2 weeks with all the kind of WrestleMania stuff, they have really, really struggled in 18 to 34. It's nosedive. And I always say, you know, the quick three ways of getting 18 to 34 is to do a big match between, you know, two stars or a return or, you know, like a retirement, whichever way you want to look at it. You know, these people coming back from old actually triggers the younger audience far more than the older audience. And then the other one is to run a gimmick. And this is the gimmick. And the bit about this is that you want that audience back because next week you're going into the play-in games right before, you know, the pay-per-view. Then you're going to be into the NBA playoffs. Then you're going to be into the NHL playoffs up top. Coming straight out of that, you know, you're not too long off till you're into the Olympic Games.
Right.
Coming into, and then so forth onto the, and then we're into political season. So, you know, what we talked about with ratings, with rankings, you know, if you're going to keep your high ranking, then you need to be able to put up that number as big as possible. And you want to be delivering, you know, this is the key thing. So as much as the ranking's important, they also want to be delivering as high figures as possible because that's going to affect their value in their TV negotiations.
Right. Right.
And he has chased ratings in the last few weeks. You know, the Mercedes Moné coming in so early on TV was because they were chasing that rating. So this is a part of that. And, you know, yeah, it was successful. You know, even when we look at their strategy. So they actually use a similar strategy. Do you remember when MJF did the shoot promo?
Yes.
Yeah, back in June 1st on 2022. They used a similar strategy where they put, you know, a recognizable name up front to do the lead-in catch-in. And then they ran his promo and then into an ad break. So this time they did it slightly differently. So they used a recognizable name. They used Adam Copeland. They did they did the Samoa Joe angle as well first. But the first match, you know, they used Adam Copeland. So he will keep that retention. They put two of their big angles out first. So they did the Samoa Joe Swerve Strickland thing. And then they did the video for the Trent Barretta turn.
Yep.
So the idea is that they know people are going to tune in big from the start because they don't know when this thing is coming. And that's kind of the hype that's built up. So you get all your important stories out there early. You try and keep as much of the audience as possible by keeping the screen kind of there as long as possible. So there's two picture-in-picture breaks in the first half an hour. And then they ran an ad break right before the footage because they knew that they'd get that retention back. And they did. You know, they went from when they started the promo, they come out of the ad break. So if you ever want to know how long a full ad break goes down to, they actually dropped from 950,000 before the ad break to 646,000 with a full ad break. So it's a huge impact. So when you're looking at quarter hours and stuff, you have to take these into account. But they come out of the ad break at 809,000. And by the time they get to the main part of the Bucks promo, they're up at 928,000, 917,000, back to 920 just after the footage. And this is mostly powered by 18 to 49. You actually find that 50 plus actually drops. And then once you get to the FDR promo, you know, you drop from that 920 to 838K by the end of promo. But it did its job in quarters that normally wouldn't deliver that. And then people stuck around. You know, they stuck around to the end of the show. So as a ratings thing, it worked. And you can use other things now going forward to that. You know, you've got people to come back. Moxley's back on Wednesday night.
Yep. We can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, we'll come back to that one. But that's a big guy to get back. You've got other people to come back, you know, whether it's Adam Cole doing things on TV or on a regular basis. MJF, who I imagine will be back by UBS, Forbidden Door at UBS Arena. I think that sets a day for him. You know, you've got Paige to come back. You've got Christian, who's conspicuous by his absence at the moment, to come back onto TV. So you have these things, and you know, returns are always good for that. But we are using a gimmick. I think my biggest frustration with it is that you have this gimmick. You have something to attract people's attention, but you build a show around it that was a little bit mediocre.
Yeah. It wasn't a particularly good episode of Dynamite, and I think this added to a lot of the fan angst about it, right? Is that, you know, a mediocre episode of Dynamite causes people to lose their minds to begin with, right? Sure. So that's on top of that. And then on top of that, you had this footage and that the angle was kind of about it. And so I think there was a lot more distress than there would have been if you had had an absolute kick-ass show with some phenomenal matches, even if they had done what Collision last night did, which Collision was a this week was a much better episode of the show than Dynamite. I don't think we can disagree with that. But yeah, I think, yes, from a ratings perspective, this was successful. From an angle perspective, I would say I didn't know. Part of the benefit here, though, is that we have Windy City Riot to look at, right? And the reception that Jack Perry got as part of that show, which was pretty much incredible. And I think if you want to look at the success of this, there is something to be said for the way he was received at that show. I mean, the reaction to him, it was the hottest match on the card. People were absolutely going nuts for it. People were cheering the hell out of him, which I think is, again, a bigger problem that you're going to have, right? Because you're bringing him back as a heel. Again, you're showing us that this guy's a heel, but I think to a lot of people in AEW's audience, they saw that video footage and they think, this poor fucking guy, right? He's a baby. He is a scapegoat.
He absolutely looks a scapegoat. Yes. You can't claim otherwise.
No.
Yeah, so in terms of Jack, you know, the big challenge is when you bring him back, if you, I think I would put him with the Bucks still. I know people suggested putting him in straight babyface, and yeah, you want to do that, but put him with the Bucks. It's good for him for experience. It's good for him to have people behind him while he's in a more high profile role. And, you know, don't let him out by himself. It will benefit him. But my most important thing was there was two things. So, and we asked our friend Mike that went to the show. He pointed out that people had fun with it, and it was very much different from the reception to Matt Riddle, which was much more uncomfortable. And that's the key. So if you are going to do something like this and you're going to create this kind of atmosphere, it's like the Cena thing, you know, back in the day.
Yeah,
it was fun. You know, there wasn't this kind of aggression or apathy, you know, apathy like we saw at Forbidden Door with the punk thing.
Yeah.
You know, people didn't want it. It wasn't like they wanted to be part of it. And that's kind of a unique energy that they haven't had for a while. So they need to capitalize on that. You know, and when he comes back, you need to spotlight him. And also, you know, you need to have that merch ready, you know, forget your normal kind of barriers that you put to these things and it needs to be on a cycle and wait. No, everything needs to be ready to go. You need to promote this guy. This is a unique opportunity provided by circumstance. And, you know, he can think he's done everything right in terms of doing this, but it's in terms of the time period and stuff, but this is a guy that potentially wasn't even coming back at one point. So it's kind of a weird one. But you have this circumstance now. You have this kind of in place and you have this energy and you need to capitalize on it. But you also need to convert it so it's not CM Punk chants at him all the time. And it's something that, you know, his role that he plays in AEW. And I thought, you know, I thought he was really good on Friday. It's the best instincts I've ever seen him kind of show.
The way he worked the crowd was really impressive. It was really impressive. And I think people who were like, ah, it's fucking terrible. Like, again, we've talked about this before, this whole concept of like everybody has to be perfect in everything all the time, always. And if they're not, then they should be off TV and get rid of them and yada, 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 right? like going to Japan was great for him. Like working with House of Torture was great for him. Like figuring out like fan response and managing to work the crowd. It was almost Young Bucks-esque in some ways, right? The way that he leaned into the reception he got from the crowd. And like you said, every fan knows the difference between when the crowd is really mad and when the crowd is playing along. And it was very clear that the crowd was playing along and everybody was having a good time. And I think there's, like, why you want to squander something like this? Like you said, make the promotion a babyface again, right? Like, this is an easy way. This is a shortcut way to do that. But if you're just going to not do anything with this, or you're afraid of it, or what have you, like, it's not going to work.
No, you've dug your hands into it now. So, you know, get on with it. Use it. And, you know, eventually you need to turn him babyface.
Yeah.
But you need to run with this guy. You need to run with this guy. Whether you know, personally, whatever you feel, I don't really care. There's something there and you need to run with it. And he's obviously matured. And I think we are very quick to write people off. You know, yes. The thing is that we never used to see people's journeys so much. By the time they got to like a WWE or something like that, we were seeing them kind of mid-career. We're not now. We see people as they develop, and people are very, very sharp and very, very quick to write people off. And a lot of the time it's not even on them. It's like the positioning and other things. So, you know, let's give him the benefit of what he can go out and do. And yeah, you have to figure out a way to give him a key point in your show, just as everybody else. And that will only benefit them. You know, that female 18 to 34 number, it was crazy. It's not just
crazy.
Because,
yeah. So highest female number since like fucking January, Trish. It was insane.
Yeah. So there's a funny little thing about that. And people are like, oh, you know, they just want the drama or to see the Punk footage or they're into Punk. Well, that demo has never been into Punk. That demo has always been showing. You know, we look at the collision figures. You can look at other things as well. When he won the belt, you know, that was the demo that dropped that June 1st show. There's a number of them, like, and that's consistent. I mean, that goes back to WWE as well in the past. But with that audience, he isn't. Jack, you know, Jungle Boy and Hook thing was huge in female 84.
Yes.
He has an audience there. And actually, to be fair, female 84, let's be honest, some of them, the large part of the audience just hates Punk. So I'm not surprised.
Again, this is the part, like, I get that, like, there's a vocal fucking minority. Like, again, there's a vocal fan base of Punks. And I understand that they're loud and they take up a lot of the oxygen. But it just makes me worry sometimes because I'm like, dude, you know what your freaking audience wants. Understand what you should be serving to people and stop fucking trying to play to this bullshit. People are over it. Right?
Yeah. And like, the thing is that I think some of the negativity came out because of the reports the following day after the show, where it illustrated that a lot of talent are over it as well.
Yeah.
And I know that people don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear that, you know, people didn't like the idea.
Right.
And, you know, there's been some very carefully worded reporting this week.
Yeah.
You know, from the SAT response on Thursday to Dave Meltzer's Observer stuff on Friday, where it's very clear nobody has disputed that nobody was for the footage.
Right.
You know, there's lots of talk about segments and wanting to make money and move forward, but nobody has actually disputed that they wanted the footage out there. And I can see that because people want to move on. People in the company want to move on.
Right.
They want to progress these stories. They want to spend time on, you know, building other people, not playing into a guy that's a babyface in another company. And they babyfaced him. AEW babyfaced him too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, they spent the whole time when he was out babyfacing him. You bring him back as a hero, you know, after Brawl Out. You let him run his mouth on media. You silence everybody else that could talk about him.
Right.
And there's many a story that, you know, so it's you babyfaced him. So you made these own consequences. You turned half a part of your audience on some of these guys.
Yeah.
So you are partly responsible for it. So yeah, some of your talent don't want to hear it. They want to move on. But people struggle with hearing that because it's that negativity around it. And well, that definitely played into Thursday.
There is a chunk of the fan base that refuses to believe anything negative about Tony Khan, or that Tony Khan could make mistakes, or that, you know, it's almost, you think back to like medieval and early modern era interpretations of monarchy, right? And it's never the monarch who's the bad guy. It's always the advisors are the bad guy, right? Like it's the advisors are the problem. And it seems to be, you know, it's Jimmy Jacobs, it's Pat Buck, it's this, it's that, it's, you know, it's never Brian Danielson, oddly enough. But like, it's always, I can't believe I made a reference of it. Anyway, it's always people around Tony that are making the bad choices. It's not Tony himself. And I think there is still a chunk of the fan base that will give him the benefit of the doubt, even when all of the evidence points to him being, you know, responsible or stubborn or unaware or unwilling, right? Or, you know, someone who would send Jungle Boy home for 9 months because he got pushed.
Or not use Ryan Nemeth since August.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. right? Like, you don't want to believe that about someone that, for the most part, you want to think is a good person. And listen, human beings are fucking complicated, okay? There are very few people who provide us with the example of evil that a Vince McMahon does, right? Everyone fucks up and does things wrong, and everyone has relationships and feelings, and it's easy to say when a vacuum you should do this and that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to, everybody has their side of the story and whatever. But it is always so funny to me that people are just unwilling. It's, oh, well, Tony didn't know about it, or he wouldn't do that. There's got to be a reason for this, right? There must be something that's happening here. And it's like, sometimes there just fucking isn't.
The thing with that is that it's no difference to what's happening with Paul Levesque in WWE.
Yeah.
The way that people build them up. And I get it. Look, it was Tony's decision. And yep. Once Tony made the decision, everybody decided to do their jobs and make the best out of it.
Yes.
And that's what you ask for. That's what you want out of a roster. Other than Danhausen and his tweets and stuff. That's why people like that just, they're no value to you. But it's, that's what they're going to do. And they will continue to try and make the best out of this for going forward. And that's it. But I think there's some context here is that I can understand why he wanted to push back.
Yes.
Because WWE were constantly doing it. Punk was back in doing his interview, and then he's taking shots on the pre-show on Saturday constantly. This wasn't stopping. They were going to continue rolling with that. All of a sudden, that announcement came out, and the next day wasn't anywhere near as much.
No.
And there's been nothing since. You have to push back, or they will continually push at you.
Yes.
You have to change the narrative with WWE. You've got to tackle this huge media machine and all of Nick Khan's kind of things that he uses. It's not easy. And they have to do this in an environment where they're trying to secure a TV deal.
Right.
And it's when you just kind of acquiring other talent isn't enough, because they will always find a way to twist it. And that's what Triple H tried to do very much so this week. So you have to push back. And you have to push back on CM Punk as well.
Yeah.
And it's about time, to be honest, because you've let him have free will to talk his side wherever he comes out. He needs to know that actually, you're going to carry on like this, then there will be repercussions. And yeah, I don't think it should be back on TV. You need to separate your TV product from it.
But agreed.
If you put out anything, and I don't even think he has anything really else to say, but if you put other things out there, there needs to be pushback, and there can be. Lord knows there can be. There are plenty of stories left to tell. So you have to put this thing to stop this continuation of what has been happening, because it's no good for your product. And it's no good for everybody going WCW 2000. I'm sick and tired of hearing about it. This is in perspective here, right? People talk about WCW 2000 and the finger poke of doom and all this stuff. And they talk about it because that was a company that failed.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you an example. I can't believe when I read this. And this was a friend of ours mentioned it. And I went back and I pulled out The Observer from October in 1997. So this is a show right after the death of Brian Pillman. And it opens with a 10-bell salute. And then during the show,
This is a WWF show, we should clarify.
Yeah, this is a Raw. This is a Raw.
Yes.
And, this was... So in October of 1997... they were behind, way behind Nitro. So Raw did an average of 2.4, and Nitro did an average of 3.9 rating. Yeah, we're talking like 0.8 now. It's mad, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nuts.
WWF even was starting to find some kind of form. The rise of Steve Austin in particular, DX kind of taking off, and by December they were up at 3.1. Nitro were very much consistent where they were. So that's your kind of fix it. WWF at this time were the second company, and they were far behind. Yeah. So yeah, we've had the death of Brian Pillman, and then during the show, they are doing interviews with Brian Pillman's wife for a ratings ploy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also on that show, straight after a 10-bell salute, they have a promo with DX. And this is a thing from The Observer. So they showed the famous click curtain call from MSG where Michaels, Helmsley, Ramone and Diesel broke kayfabe and hugged and made fun of McMahon for what they did. They came back and Brett came out mainly to challenge Helmsley, although it wound up with shoot comments flying back and forth. Brett called Michaels and Helmsley homos and said he made more money than them, all three of them combined. On that same show, you also had Cornette doing kind of anti-NWO videos. None of this is on that level.
Showing this footage is not on that level. Does it get compared to that? No. You know why? Because WWE got hot.
Yep.
So it didn't matter. What happened here in terms of showing this footage ultimately doesn't matter. What matters is what comes out of it. What results do you gather? Do you turn Jack Perry into a star? Do you get more heat on the Young Bucks that makes them, you know, more money for beating them? Because it's, you know, the chase going forward. Does it get more attention to your show that you can keep on for next week going into the playoffs and give you that momentum when you need to be delivering results in your TV year? That's what matters. You know, history is written by the victors, right? That's why we don't compare it to that show. We don't look at that show, which has much worse examples of ratings ploys. No, we compare it to the one that failed. And that's all about how we talk about things. And that's not to say, you know, I thought it was great in terms of how it was executed. It's not to say that I agree that it should have been on TV. And it's not to say that I don't think, you know, they should have promoted something more around it, especially in terms of, you know, the challenger for the world champion.
Yep.
And for next week to kind of hook people in at the time, you know, not promoting matches like 3-4 days later. But it doesn't matter in a great deal as much as people think it does. No. What matters is what they do next.
I feel like we can put that box away now.
Yeah. Look, there's going to be, you know, it'll come back up at some point. But they all want to move on. We want to move on. Yeah. And they need to focus on the product, you know. You need to focus on the build for this pay-per-view. I've not been particularly infused by this cycle. I think there's been some illogical stuff, especially with kind of Ospreay and the Callis family.
Yeah.
That's had a little heat and made no sense. There's a lot of weak pro, you know, I think everybody's talking to Geoff about Billy Gunn and Jay White and the six-man program and how much of a disaster that is. Yeah, there's some good stuff on there, and I'm sure there's things that people are excited for, but I think they need to get out this cycle. You need to get some of your names back on TV. And doing things that are entertaining. There needs to be kind of that logical booking. And I know they've got things planned for, you know, going forward to kind of build up towards All In. We need to execute them. You know, you need to not be focusing on anything else but executing them and getting the results that you require. And, you know, that goes from you need to promote your next world champion as a world champion. You know.
Well, that's part of the... I think that's part of it, right? So this is my big concern going into Wednesday, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, we had Collision last night, which I watched, which I enjoyed, but a lot of the show was taken up with talking about Jon Moxley's victory at Windy City Riot over Tetsuya Naito, or as Tony Schiavone called him, Naito.
Aww.
He was very cute. Naito. I was like,
Naito.
Okay. Naito.
Nice.
And I think, you know, putting that aside, because I think we'll talk about that show and, you know, the overall direction with New Japan in a minute, you know, we're now saying, you know, we already are having issues with centering this title feud in this pay-per-view build, because we're spending a lot more time and video package energy on Ospreay versus Danielson than we are on Swerve versus Samoa Joe. The program itself doesn't feel as hot, although, you know, depending on who you're talking to, I think some folks are struggling with Ospreay versus Danielson as well. Others are super excited for it. You know, everybody has their preferences. But you're now on Wednesday going to take Jon Moxley, who's one of your biggest stars and one of your biggest ratings movers, and you're going to put him on TV with another belt, and you're going to run the risk of telling your audience that the IWGP World Championship is more important than your AEW World Championship, or you're going to present it in such a way where it comes across as more important. That's like a big concern for me right now. I don't know that that's something they should be doing, as much as I think they do need to have Mox back on TV, and as happy I am for Mox that he won the championship.
I think they got the balance wrong in this cycle, and I think it's difficult because it's evident that he doesn't see Joe in the same way as he even saw Paige, which is feels like a crazy thing to say, doesn't it? But in terms of ratings, so there has been less focus. And, you know, Joe gives Swerve less room to maneuver. So, but the key is, so the thing with Swerve is, and he has become a little bit of our talisman, I think, about this, is when you look at WWE and their successes, it's that they are able to elevate upwards. And people buy in that they can, even if they don't. So Sami Zayn, right? He gets elevated all the way up. He comes back down to his normal level. But people accept that because they saw him go all the way up. what happens in AEW is you have your place and you can beat top guys, but you still have your place.
Right.
Eddie Kingston, I always bring up that example. You know, you can beat top guys, but actually you weren't treated as a big thing when you lost the belt. You were still the guy that you were. And people struggle to get out of that structure. So now we've got new people coming in, and you'll get someone like Ospreay or Okada come in, and they are treated as the top level star and positioned like that.
Right.
And you can have a Brian Keith come in, and he will be treated as he's a jobber, and that's his level. And we don't see people escape their levels very often.
No.
You know? When was the last time? Maybe they claimed? I was trying to think about this, but is that the last time somebody moved levels?
Yeah, I would probably say the Acclaimed. I think you could argue MJF, but I think MJF was always
He was always set up for that top level. Yeah. He was always presented at top level.
I would probably say the Acclaimed. Mm-hmm. I think you could argue, at least most recently, yes.
Yeah, and that's a long time ago. So people struggle to escape the kind of ceilings they put on. Swerve is the first guy, yeah, probably since the Acclaimed, that is nearly able to do that.
Yes.
So you need to, you have to tell fans that they can trust you, that when they get behind somebody, you're going to get behind them.
Yep.
Whether you believe in it or not. You can't lose that. That's such an important thing in wrestling, that people believe, I'm really into this guy, therefore I'm going to be rewarded for my investment. So you have to focus on this guy. And you haven't done it so much in the build. You know, you've had new debuts coming in, you've had this and that. Whatever, that's done. Okay, so you need to make, he needs to cut a babyface promo on Wednesday night. Yep. And you need to make that moment, I believe it'll be a dynasty. I've always believed it's going to be a dynasty now, ever since they came straight to it after the pay-per-view.
Yes.
You've put yourself in a position now where there's no way out of it. You know, they went straight back to after a week. I wasn't a big fan of that. When somebody turns babyface, they need a setback and they need a bit of a longer chase.
Yes.
Or they can do, you can do the Austin 98 thing where they can win the belt, but then they lose it quickly.
Right.
We are now in a situation where you can't do either of these things with Swerve. Okay. So you can't do that next kind of pushback because you went straight to that match and it's a one-on-one. You know, you can't get out of it in that way. The best option would have been to find a way to get the belt on Paige and then have him chase Paige down the wall. And we haven't got that. That's always been my thing. That's always what I thought they should do. You now have a point where I believe he won at Dynasty. You then have to focus on him. You need to have the right people with him. He needs to face an experienced heel.
Yep.
You know, which is why we always going about Christian Cage. You know, that is the only guy I can think of on the roster that fits that thing currently. And then you need to do that Hangman program. You need to do that program. You know, because that's where he gained the most momentum and Paige is such an easy guy for him to play off. The key thing is, though, is that, you can't overshadow him. So if you're going to have all these other belts and you're going to put all these people somewhere, then you need to be really careful of that. There's this undercurrent of you have Danielson versus Ospreay. Well, if Ospreay beats Danielson, and I believe from the promos that that video they showed on Dynamite,
it certainly seems like it now.
Yeah, it made the story Danielson going, on a losing streak and losing belief in himself seems to be that story. So that feels to me like, okay, so Ospreay would be surely like very high in the rankings. So how do you get out of that one? That's a key question.
Yep.
And then that brings us to kind of the Wembley thing is you have to keep him one hot as a babyface. You need to give him focus. You need to not make the mistakes that you made with Adam Page. He's not coming in as hot as Page or MJF did. So he's going to need more focus than these guys did. But also, the idea, and I know why people are so into the Ospreay at Wembley thing. I get it. It makes sense in terms of you don't think about it too much. I don't think there's anything in the current numbers that says you need to speedrun this guy.
No, I don't either.
And I think there is this tendency of Tony to want to jump to that next generation and his chosen guys to kind of get over the things that, funny enough, this kind of release of this footage pulls him back into. Like he can just move on to new people, but I don't think it works like that. It doesn't work like that. We've seen that in the ratings, when we lose people. But you have to concentrate on this guy. And if you were going to do that at Wembley, so you're going to tell me that you're going to have your first ever black male heavyweight champion. And then 3 months later, you're going to have this guy booed in the biggest stadium show they do each year.
Yeah.
Is that what you're aiming for? Do you understand how that looks? I'm sorry, right? I know people don't want to talk about this stuff, but do you understand how that looks? And then if you were going to take the belt off him and he'd have on the shorter title reigns, you got to be really careful. You have to make this guy work. And he's talented enough to do it. And he has the crossover connections and that sort of thing. You have to make him work. I don't care what you wanted to do. You know, this is where Tony struggles sometimes, is he has a destination, and this pay-per-view has felt like that as well. He has a destination, and he doesn't want to adapt from it.
No.
So sometimes he'll give you, like, the Thunder Rosa run. He'll give somebody a run, but you can tell when he doesn't believe in it. The same way when he didn't believe in the Adam Page run because he was already on to wanting Punk CM and Max. Punk. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can tell when, and the audience can now as well. They're used to that structure. So you have to make this work, not just for Swerve, and because you can make this guy, and he's more than talented enough to be in that position, but for that audience to show that you can reward that investment in somebody.
Well, it's the frustrating part right now of a lot of the Swerve dialogue. You know, Swerve's not ready, Swerve's not the guy. And I'm like, how much of the way that the promotion is presenting him is factoring into how you feel about that, right? And that's, in no way do I want to negate anyone's feelings. You know, people are allowed to feel however they want to feel. But I do think there are times where we have to take a deep breath and say, do I not think he's the guy, or is the promotion telling me that he is not? Because they are centering someone else.
It's the same thing they're doing in WWE now. You know, look at the on Raw, look at how Damian Priest was treated compared to Cody Rhodes.
Right.
They told you Priest is not a long-term investment. He's not a centerpiece guy. You know, we give 45 minutes at the start of the show to Cody Rhodes. We did a thing. And that's what you should do with a champion. Let's be clear. That's it. You know, but when you have another guy come out halfway through the show and he's kind of in the background and they call him transitional and it's very clear that he is, he's not the guy. People can spot this stuff a mile off. You know, they don't need you to tell them. But visually and the way you position somebody, you're also telling them. And yeah, people are used to the pattern with that. It's just one of them things, but you've got to get it right. And, I've hoped they do. And there's other things, you know, they've got to get... Have we got an Owen coming up soon? That's due this time of year, isn't it? That's another tournament they have to get right this year. You know, last year was disappointing. The first one was...
We're 0 for 2 on Owen tournaments, let's be honest.
So, you know, there has to be forward planning, and I believe there is, but yeah, you've got to execute it, and you've got, you know, it's tough. There's a lot to balance. You've got to balance all these returns in, but you need them for your rating, and, you know, the TV deal is the main priority this year.
Is very hard. I do want to say that. Like, it's super easy for us to sit here and criticize it, but actually freaking pulling it off is very difficult.
There's a lot of things to balance.
Don't envy them on this.
Yeah, but to me, like, the first priority is you make Swerve.
Yeah.
You prove that you can do that in a way that you didn't at the time with Paige and haven't really done with anyone else in terms of elevating them out their level since the Acclaimed. Prove it. So, should we do a couple of the AEW listener questions before I
forget? Yes, which one do you want to start with, Trish? I'm going to put you on the spot.
Put me on the spot. So, question from listener Chris Chopin. Long-time friend of ours.
Yes.
Or our pod. So, given a Young Bucks graphic and the SRS story, is it safe to assume that fences have been mended between Tony and Elite and Hangman won't be punished anymore going forward? Oh, bless. I love it. I'm just going to think about it. If you've ever worked with somebody and something's happened and it's fractured your relationship, it's difficult. You know, it's not simple to kind of get back to the same level. And I think it's very much a case of it's a changed relationship, but that's not always a bad thing. The key with Hangman is he's valuable now. And, you know, he showed that, you know, he opened more shows between January and Revolution than anybody else. So they acknowledge his value. You know, the Swerve program did way better than anybody thought it would do.
Yes.
It's very much helped them with the full gear number, which rescued that number, you know, which would have sat around 125,000 if it wasn't for the kind of thing around that match. So he's proving his value. And the thing with him as well is not just that, is that he can make something out of anything.
Yeah.
Time and time again, you know. So, yeah, I have no worries about him going forward, I don't think. We all miss him, though. We're back to where the fuck is Hangman? Like, we know why, but it's like, we're back to where the fuck is Hangman?
It's just a brutal pay-per-view cycle for that, because you're just missing just enough people for it to be kind of eh, and the rest of it is just sort of eh, and you're kind of like, all right, you know.
Yeah,
we'll get through it, and I'm sure there'll be some fucking phenomenal matches. There always are phenomenal matches, right?
Sure.
But from a heat perspective, I'm like, yeah, it'll be fine.
And our second question is from listener Sean, and it said, this was a question that wasn't discussed when we discussed ratings. So,
where do the numbers that WBD releases factor into the equation? Are they more or less important? I've seen a lot of people write them off because of the WrestleNomics post about them, including Big Bang Theory. And the thing about this, there was a WBD press release this week that highlighted all the successes of the different networks. Did you see that one?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
Cool. And, you know, it highlighted that TBS is the number one ranked cable entertainment network in total day and a prime viewership amongst 25 to 54. And also that TNT was the number one rank for 18 to 49 adults amongst all networks. And they highlighted AW content in there, mentioned that they get 4 million viewers weekly. And, you know, that figure is made up by how many people watch a minute, which is where the Big Bang Theory thing comes in. So when you get a normal rating, so say if you get, say they say you have 850,000 viewers. Well, that's not actually technically correct because that's how many people watch the entire show.
Right.
So if you watch half a show, you are worth half a person on a rating. So that's where you kind of get the differentiation there. Plus you got DVR, which is not as much as people think. You know, average DVR can be between 80,000 to kind of 200,000 max for Rampage, Collision and Dynamite. So, but that's how you can, but the thing about these press releases that's important is not actually the figures. It's that they're included in the first place.
Right.
So it shows the value that they have in that offering that WBD are providing. So that is always my first priority with these things. And it also shows, you know, what's important to them. So they talk a lot about 25 to 54, which is why keeping that 35 to 49 demographic high is so important as well. So where is the NHL in these press releases? Nowhere to be found. Kicked Dynamite off TNT, didn't it? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll see it in the next thing. But yeah, the whole point is that it shows that there is an investment from that side into AEW and into their offering, and that is a good omen going forward. So I actually don't think the numbers in that press release are massively important, but the fact that they are getting the recognition from their network is a lot more. So
I think our friend Maura is always quick to point out to us, and justifiably so, that WBD is likely using numbers and statistics in regards to how they track ratings that we, the general public, do not have access to. Mm-hmm. So the Nielsen number is important, but not the end-all be-all in terms of at least how the network views the importance. And again, I think one of the things that Dave pointed out this week when it came to the rating is that even the 0.23 number that Dynamite did the week before last still had it as number three in entertainment programs for the week, right? It was the number three ranked program in the demo for entertainment programs for the week, okay? So while we may have a lot of agita about individual numbers, as we talked about in the ratings episode, Dynamite is still doing incredibly well when it comes to comparison to others. Now, obviously, they want to get that demo up because they want to continue to increase that rights feeds. It's not like it's without. But it's clear that they are valued by WBD, and that is pretty important.
We need to get out of this cycle, and we need them to sort that TV deal, and so much of this noise will dissipate.
Right.
Should we talk some New Japan?
Windy City Riot.
What a great show.
It was very enjoyable. A lot of the matches were excellent. Mm-hmm. The vibes were spectacular, as the kids like to say.
I feel like everyone thinks I'm going to be crying in this segment. That's the vibe I've had.
I do like to bust your chops about Naito, as he is called.
It's so funny because, you know, a lot of people, if anyone's known me long term, they'll know that, you know, 2010s, my favorite wrestlers were Tetsuya Naito, John Moxley, or Dean Ambrose, as he was then, and Pentagon Jr. So it's not like I'm that sad. But the funny thing was is when we did the episode where I kind of went off on this as a business case, the next day I found out that Moxley was winning. And then I talked to our friends at Keeping It Strong Style, and they'd heard it from a completely different source, which is always good because if you get source material from one source, especially if it's secondhand, you know, if you get something direct, it's different. But when you get something secondhand, what you're really looking for is somebody else to kind of confirm it with a different source.
Yes.
And that really helped. So as soon as I got that, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. It was literally like before our episode came out. So that was kind of funny. But yeah, so there's a lot of things to discuss with this one and with Mox. I think
I'm not against the decision. I think you can see it going back to Tetsuya Naito.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you've got, so there was a Body Slam report, and I'd like to get somebody else to kind of look at the last part of this, which said he is going to work with Dontaku, he's going to work Dominion. Obviously, we know he's going to work Resurgence. And they said he was going to work Kazuna Road, which is not a tour running this year. Instead, they're running the New Japan Seoul Tour from the middle of June, starting in Hokkaido, and ends on July 5th in Adachi, Tokyo, at the Budokan, which happens to be Naito's hometown, and he promised a champion's roll call. So, interesting. So, yeah, a lot of people... So, one of the other things was, is when we found out the kind of... When we got the kind of thing about Moxley, was you go and you look at the schedule. And Dontaku suddenly had an American flag all over it. Resurgence suddenly had a world title defense straight after Dontaku. You know, these little things where people went, oh, okay, this is just kind of confirming a little bit more of what we already knew. And this is another thing, you know, you look at that schedule and you think, I don't see a way that belt doesn't go back on Tetsuya Naito by the 5th of July. You know?
Yeah.
But the thing about Jon Moxley is that, and I said, you know, I'm going to repeat a little bit of stuff I said on Keeping It Strong Style, so apologize for anyone that's heard it on there already. But this is not a guy that's going to sit at home with the belt or not be able to get over and because of visa or whatever else, like Kenny last year. This is a guy that is going to go and work these shows. He'll do tours. You know, he flew for Independence Day to do, you know, a tag match against Desperado and Jun Kasai last year. Right. He loves New Japan. You know, sometimes, you know, I often wonder if he loves it more than AEW, but he loves New Japan. And this is a huge honor for him. And it's something he's always wanted to do. He's also really great at working with young talent. You know, yes. We've seen it with Wheeler Yuta. We've seen it in many of the matches that he's had, you know, Garcia, whoever. He's really good at that. And they have a lot of young talent that's still very green and needs that kind of extra thing to him. And he's more physically able to do that than Tetsuya Naito. Who probably provides a better thing, a different thing to learn. So it's an opportunity for him to go and do that. You know, they've set up a match with Ren Narita. Tokyo Sports seems to think it's at Dontaku. The poster comments seem to think it's at Resurgence. So hopefully we'll get some clarity on that in the next couple of days. And then there's a match with Shota Umino. And the fact that they're doing that so early suggests that it's not going to be a long run, which I imagine will be at Dominion because that will be 5 years from their first match together.
Yes.
At Dominion. So that makes sense. And Moxley, you know, they won it in Wintrust, the way he won his AEW title. He's very much into kind of them sort of milestones. He loves that sort of trivia stuff. So it makes perfect sense. But it's, yeah. And the thing is, you've got to ask is, what would Moxley have done in AEW this year?
Yeah.
You know? If he'd stayed in AEW and he wasn't doing this New Japan run, what was he going to do? You know, he spent most of last year putting people over. That they didn't do anything with after.
That they didn't do anything with.
So, you know, he puts over Adam Page. We all know what happened there. He puts over Orange Cassidy. Orange Cassidy goes back to the same spot. And actually, you know, then the person that beats Orange Cassidy is now a lower spot than he was.
Yeah.
He puts over Eddie Kingston. And then Danielson puts over Eddie Kingston. And Marvin are making anything out of that to make the match with Okada bigger. It's a random TV throwaway match where he's the secondary. And now the pay-per-view match is Okada and Pac. You know, so he has done his best from his personal perspective to elevate people, and then they haven't made potentially what they should have of them afterwards. But he also, he's 38, you know? He's not some 50-year-old guy that's got no knees or struggling physically or can't deliver. This is one of your biggest ratings draws, arguably the most consistent ratings draw in the last 5 years. And one of your best wrestlers, and he's in the prime of his career. And these are competitive people. These aren't people that want to sit by the sidelines. These aren't people that don't want to be involved in that kind of fight for the main event or to All In. You know, nobody's writing Moxley. You know, no one in the company was writing Moxley in for something like that. No one in fan base. You know, you see everyone writing their lists out on who's going to do this and who's going to do that. People aren't factoring in Jon Moxley anymore. That sort of thing drives people insane. You know, they want to be successful. They want to be the guy. They want to have that company on their back. People like that live for it. And he wasn't going to do that in AEW. And, you know, we can argue all day about his usage. And, you know, he's still prominent, but he's going to want more. That's a natural thing. So this gives him the opportunity to do that and to move away, you know, and to come away a little bit from being on TV every week in AEW and make him, you know, make the fans kind of recognize him again. realize yes. that this guy is yes. important, realize what he achieves on a weekly basis that we've now kind of taken for granted. You know, it's that new toy syndrome, isn't it? It's a Toy Story yeah. thing somewhat. So it's a perfect opportunity for him to have this kind of short run to draw some houses. You know, the New Japan number was 6028 for this show. I know WrestleTix had a lower number, but it's hard to compare because we don't have a WrestleTix number for the Cow Palace. So if we go off the New Japan numbers, it was slightly lower than the Cow Palace. So yeah, Kenny and Cody are still safe, bless them. But it's hard to explain to people how good this number was. You know, it's dwarfed every number from New Japan since the dual show with Ring of Honor at Madison Square Garden. You know, it beats the first night of Tanahashi and Okada in Dallas. So if you compare it to, you think about Ring of Honor, right, gets all this kind of TV hype, and they use Jon Moxley for shows. None of their attendances have ever got really near. I think they've had one quite close, but never crossed the line of the Kenny Omega-Cody Rhodes match at the WrestleMania 34 weekend. And that's with all the TV exposure and all the press things behind it. You can argue that New Japan have far less of that these days
yeah.
than ever before, because their market share in America especially has been reduced because of the presence of AEW. So this is a big number. This is a big feather in the cap of both Jon Moxley and Tetsuya Naito. You know, that guy that's not popular in the US, by the way, who actually got a bigger reception than Jon Moxley. I was going to say,
more people were cheering for him than yeah. they were for Moxley.
Funny how that works sometimes in the yeah. US, isn't it? But yeah, it's a huge number for them. And the other thing about Moxley, where I can see the reason to do this, is you know, they run their pay-per-view solely through New Japan World on the, for the outside of Japanese market. I think it was on TV Asahi in Japan. So they want people to subscribe back to World.
Yes.
You know, they changed World last year. And when people talk about the Q4 or the Q2 figure in Japan, as it is, for that last part of last year, one of the biggest impacts was the change to World and that loss of subscription and not having a show immediately to pick them up. And I don't know if Wrestle Kingdom this year did what they essentially wanted to do. It's not like when Kenny went back, you know, that would actually, in hindsight, if you could do it in a perfect world, Kenny going back this year after that change would have been much more kind of influential for them. So yes. you now have an opportunity to kind of build up your World subscriptions and using a guy like Jon Moxley to do so in the West, but then also having Best of Super Juniors, getting him over there in Japan, and then getting it back onto Tetsuya Naito to have the young guys chase through the G1. So you can fulfill many different things with this. So, yeah, I think it's a good move for Mox at this period of time. I think it's going to work for New Japan in a lot of ways. It's going to work for Shota Umino, who I thought looked fantastic on Friday compared to recent stuff. Most comfortable seems to be in his skin is when he's in the US, which is quite worrying in a way. I don't take him. Like he's, but you know, that's important as well, because the aim should be to establish Shota, especially because he's the most well-known of all the younger guys to yes. the you know, the US and the Western audiences. So if you can establish him as a future guide to that audience, it's going to help you move him forward. And that should be a primary reason to do this.
I think it makes sense. You know, I think AEW will miss Mox, but I also mm-hmm. think, like you said, there's a degree of which, like, what is he going to do? You know, and given the amount of people he's put over that they are still stuck in the spot they are, mm-hmm. I could understand if he has any frustration about it, right? Mm-hmm. It's one of the more challenging things, but I also think it sort of indicates, you know, not everybody's always, it's clear that in AEW, not everybody is always on the same page with creative, right?
Yep.
Like that there's things that occur where it's like, okay, you know, there's clearly compromises and you can kind of, you know, is a tag title ladder match now.
I knew you were going to do it. I knew you were going to do it. I thought you held off for like.
I held off.
5 seconds and then off. You were like, fuck it. I'm going to
fuck it.
Yeah.
I don't care. But it's that kind of stuff, right? And that's natural and that's understandable, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, creativity and art is compromise. It's especially when you're working with other people, you have to take their needs and their feelings and everything else to account. And I think it's natural for AEW fans to want people to just fucking cooperate, but it's also natural for people to not fucking cooperate sometimes. And, you know, to quote a tattoo on a tremendous human being, it is what it is. Sorry, that's my Louis Tomlinson. Boy, I veered off.
The guy from One Direction?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's been a long week, friends.
It has.
But yeah, I don't think that there's any necessarily bad things to it. And I do think Mox having something to do while taking some time off from AEW TV is not the worst thing in the world. Because I do think AEW fans could take him less for granted.
I think he's still going to work AEW television. They need.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's not disappearing forever, but he'll be.
He'll be in and out. But they know they need him. I think.
Oh, yeah.
The last few weeks have established how much they are missing. You know, their top kind of centerpiece guys, and to be honest, you know, there's people. It sounds harsh, but there are people where not only do you miss them on screen, but it doesn't feel so much like AEW when they're not on screen.
And I think that's very valid.
And this is still a company that's kind of chasing, finding its identity still. You know, it had one, and then they kind of blew it up. And now they kind of can't work out what it is, and they have this mismatch. So, yeah, but you need a John Moxley on screen. But, yeah, it'll be exciting to see him in New Japan. It's exciting when they do something different. I wish there was more opportunities for some more of the kind of the other top men and women to do that. But, yeah, let's just get through this pay-per-view. Get them set up. Stop talking about CM Punk. And let's see where it goes. I think it's going to be a pretty interesting summer in all regards. So,
yeah.
I've been very happy on this podcast, haven't I? It's very weird.
You are. I always enjoy when you're in a good mood, Trish.
Yeah. Thank Mary Earps. Mary Earps. Yay. I wanted my Wembley pun in there somewhere. I was like, I talk about Wembley. There we go. Right. Okay. So thank you to everyone that's listened through this episode. If you have joined us for the first time for our normal episodes, this might be a bit of a shock to your system. So this has been the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast. We are produced by the incredible Leah, who can get a show out in one day that now everybody thinks we did on purpose. So
incredible.
Incredible. In fact, we hadn't even finished our after discussion. So that's it's such a help for us. So yeah, and thank you to everyone that's picked up Tunnel Talk off the back of it in recent weeks. It's so great to see feedback in places that I don't expect for Tunnel Talk.
It's a phenomenal show. Give it a listen. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but you can't hurt yourself by trying something new. And Tunnel Talk, Allie, Ann, and Leah have some of the most unique takes on AEW in general. So I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a laugh. Mm-hmm. It's just a freaking good time.
Wrestling can be fun.
Wrestling can freaking be fun. It's not all angst.
We are a proud member of the Social Suplex Network. You can find us in a Social Suplex Discord. If you want to jive at me about Naito, that's where to find us. But you can also find on their website all the other great shows, including One Nation Radio, Keeping It Strong Style, All Things Elite, Imps WWE Adventure, Wrestling Art with Chris, and, as the aforementioned, Tunnel Talk. You can also contact us at, you can find us on Twitter at TrishSpears48 or at Sarah Graps or the show Twitter. God, I can't get my words out today. The show Twitter at Trish and Sarah, at Trish and Sarah. You can also drop us an email if you want us to answer any questions, either on the pod or through reply at trishandsarahpod@gmail.com, trishandsarahpod@gmail.com. And I think that's it. We're going to have a two-week break. We're going to come back after Dynasty. I can't be doing this weekly thing. It's killing me.
It's brutal.
Okay.
We're going to run out of things to say. Like, what could we possibly have to say?
There's never enough.
It's never enough.
Never enough. Okay. So we will see you back in 2 weeks' time, and we'll discuss all the fallout from the pay-per-view. So until then, I've been Trish.
And I've been Sarah.
And this has been the Trish and Sarah Wrestling Podcast.